From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in part, in great part, by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the five-day Hindu celebration of Deepavali begins on Monday. The 11th is Diwali for Hindus, Jains, and Sikhs. Sundown Wednesday brings the Baha'i observance of the birth of Baha'u'llah. And Thursday is the Jain celebration of New Year. Gosh, it's been a busy week at the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, particularly with voters heading to the polls last Tuesday for local and state elections, with both sides receiving extensive funding and support from outside the state. The Houston Equal Rights Ordinance in Texas was voted down, 60-39. While HERO offered protections for 15 classes of Houstonians, the opposition, led by conservative Christian activists, successfully focused on fomenting fear of transgender persons in public bathrooms. Similar laws in countless other municipalities over the years have proven this to be a false panic, but in Houston, it worked. In Kentucky, where Democrats hold most all statewide offices, TV ads proclaiming Republican Matt Bevin to be a, quote, conservative Christian, helped power him to a somewhat unexpected victory, 53-44. Tacoma, Washington voters approved a $12 per hour minimum wage, while Portland, Maine rejected a $15 per hour rate. Still, a city council mandated boost to $10.10 per hour is coming next year. It's notable that all of these numbers are also part of our national political debate. President Obama supports raising the minimum wage to $10 an hour, while Hillary Clinton has just endorsed a $12 figure, and Bernie Sanders is advocating for $15. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
So what do you think about Muslims and Islam?
I think generally there is a slight misconception.
Things that like cover their head and dark skin, I guess.
Bombing.
I think about the Torah. I think that's a part of Islam, yeah.
With so much fear and misinformation about Islam continuing to permeate our public rhetoric, there could not be a better time for a new, deeply scholarly, and carefully annotated translation of the Quran, the Muslim holy book. Set to be published later this month by Harper One, the study Quran counts among its translators Dr. Joseph Lombard, who will be with us this week.
Every election is now nationalized, and these candidates going around these count forums, getting asked questions about national political issues. The local media in this country has been eviscerated.
Even as much of the national press obsesses with the presidential horse race, last Tuesday's local and state voting once again reaffirmed that significant change often happens at that local level. Interfaith Alliance is on the ground in many places across the country in the form of local affiliates. And Executive Director Jack Moline has recently been visiting a series of these. We've got a report coming up from Jack on what he's been hearing. But first,
what could the growth of nuns mean next November? If Republicans nominate a religiously conservative candidate like Carson, he might have trouble attracting support from the growing ranks of the religiously unaffiliated. 35% of millennials are now in that category.
This past spring, the comprehensive 2014 American Religious Landscape Study from the Pew Research Center made widespread headlines with findings suggesting a continuing erosion in religiosity in the country. Since then, the experts at Pew have continued to analyze the data from this enormous project, which gathered information from 35,000 adults nationwide, And they've just issued a second report which offers a wealth of insights into how we experience faith today. Dr. Greg Smith, principal researcher for the project, was with us back in May when the first report was released, and I'm delighted to be able to welcome him back to talk about these new findings. Dr. Smith, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
This new report delves deeper into the responses that led to the widespread headlines about the drop-off in American religious affiliation back in May of this year.
All of the data come from the same study, the same big, massive study we did in 2014. We call it the Religious Landscape Study. In May, we published our first report on the results of that study. That first report focused mainly on religious identity, what share of the country identifies as Christian or Protestant or Catholic or with having no religion. And it also looked at demographic characteristics of religious groups. Uh-huh. This new study that we put out just this week looks at the same data, but it looks at different questions. It looks at questions about religious beliefs and practices and about people's social and political attitudes.
There's been a lot of attention to the findings about Americans who do remain religiously affiliated, that for them, there has not been any decrease in commitment and practice. Is that accurate to say?
That is absolutely accurate. What you have happening, if you look at the public as a whole, is you are seeing modest but significant declines in different indicators of religious observance. So if we look at all Americans, we've seen a slight downturn in the share who say they believe in God. We see a slight downturn in the share who say they pray every day, a slight downturn in the number who say religion is very important in their lives or that they attend religious services regularly. All these trends are kind of moving in the same directions by modest but noticeable amounts. Those trends among the public as a whole are being driven by the growth of those people who say they have no religious identity, and by the fact that that group, those who say they're religiously unaffiliated, are becoming less religious over time. Mm-hmm. At the same time, most American adults continue to identify with a religion, continue to describe themselves as part of an organized faith, primarily Christianity. And among that group, there's been no discernible decline at all in their rates of religious observance. In fact, by some indicators, those people who identify with the religion are perhaps more observant today than was the case when we did a similar massive study back in 2007.
I also noticed the increase in spiritual well-being that you identified compared to Pew's 2007 survey. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, one of the questions people have asked us over the years is, you know, if identification with organized religion is declining and there's more and more people saying that they have no religious identity, could part of what we're seeing be just sort of a transferring of traditional modes of religious observance and practice into less traditional forms? In other words, are people becoming more spiritual even if they're becoming less religious? Mm-hmm. And we asked a few questions to try to get at that. We asked people how often they feel a deep sense of spiritual peace and well-being. We asked people how often they feel a deep sense of wonder about the universe. And both of those indicators are up significantly since we first did this kind of study. Mm-hmm. One thing that's really interesting, though, is that those indicators of increased spirituality do not appear to be a substitute for more traditional forms of religious observance. Mm. In fact, we see these increases among the population as a whole, among those who are observant religiously in traditional ways, mm-hmm. as well as among those who are not. In fact, in some ways, people who are the most observant in traditional ways are also the most likely to say they have experienced some of these spiritual questions that we asked about. Mm-hmm.
I noticed that you also looked at positions on social issues of Americans affiliated with various religious groups. There's been remarkable change there, it seems.
Well, there certainly has been remarkable change in people's views about homosexuality. We see growing acceptance of homosexuality across the board, including among religious groups that have traditionally been fairly accepting of homosexuality, as well as among groups that have traditionally been less accepting of homosexuality. For example, the share of evangelical Protestants who say homosexuality should be accepted by society has increased 10 points in just 7 years. The share of Mormons who say homosexuality should be accepted by society is up 12 points in 7 years. Now, evangelicals and Mormons are still more conservative in their attitudes about homosexuality than are many other religious groups, but they've become more accepting over time. One interesting thing that emerges from the data, though, is that that trend with respect to views about homosexuality is not seen in another important issue, abortion. Attitudes about abortion are remarkably stable, even as attitudes about homosexuality have become more accepting. So views on these twin key social issues of our time seem to be diverging in terms of the direction they're headed.
There's also analysis of the political impact of the growing percentage of religious unaffiliated nuns, particularly on the Democratic Party. In fact, I found it humorous last night, Dr. Smith. I watched several shows on different networks, and many of them covered these new findings, but they didn't know how to talk about it. They talked a little bit about their own religions and what it used to be and what it is now, but the major concern seemed to be, what are the political implications of this?
Well, I think some of the political questions are very interesting, and you're right. We are headed into election season, and we know that there's often a strong connection between religion and politics. So many people are interested in this, and I think that the question as to what the political consequences of the growth in the religious nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, mm-hmm. I think that's a very interesting question. The nuns are growing in the population as a whole, including in both political parties, but their growth is particularly pronounced within the Democratic Party. In fact, fully 28% of Democrats and those who say they lean toward the Democratic Party now say they are religiously unaffiliated, that they have no religion. That makes them more numerous than Catholics, than mainline Protestants, than members of the historically black Protestant tradition, and than any other single group within the Democratic coalition. Yeah. We also know that the religiously unaffiliated tend to vote overwhelmingly Democratic, and they tend to be quite liberal in their political and social attitudes. Mm-hmm. So the potential for the growth of this group to have real consequences for American politics is there. Mm-hmm. However, it's also important to keep in mind that when it comes to politics, the religiously unaffiliated seem to typically punch a little bit below their weight, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They are less engaged in the political process as compared to those who associate with a religion. They are less likely to be registered to vote, for example. And recent exit polls show that the growth of the nuns among voters has been far less dramatic as compared with their growth in the population as a whole. Hmm. So what will the political impact be? I think that remains to be seen, but I'll be keeping a close eye on it.
I bet. What are some of the other key findings in this latest report that I haven't asked about?
You know, we're seeing that the share of Americans who are highly religiously observant is declining. Not by a whole lot, but it is declining. Mm-hmm. Why is that happening? Well, it's not happening because there are fewer highly observant people in the United States. In fact, the number of people in the United States who are highly religiously observant is about the same today as it was when we first did this study. Mm-hmm. What's changing is that there are far more people and very rapid growth at the other end of the spectrum. There are more and more people in the United States who say, you know what, I don't associate with any religious group, and furthermore, religion really isn't important to me. Mm-hmm. That group is growing very rapidly in terms of their raw numbers. And so as their numbers grow, the share of the population that's highly observant dips a little bit, even though the number of people who are highly observant stays about the same. I think that's an important thing to remember.
Hmm. Does Pew have a working definition of religion itself?
What we try to do is look at multiple indicators. So mm-hmm. one key question we ask in all of our surveys is about religious identity. Mm-hmm. We ask people a pretty straightforward question. What is your present religion, if any? Are you mm-hmm. Protestant, Catholic, Mormon, Orthodox, such as Greek or Russian Orthodox, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, mm-hmm. atheist, agnostic, something else, or nothing in particular? Mm-hmm. We use that as our indicator of religious identity or religious affiliation. Mm-hmm. And that can tell us an awful lot about the state of American society and about American politics and so on. It doesn't tell us everything, however. Religious identity is different than religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. So in surveys like this one, we try to ask a number of questions about beliefs in God, in heaven, in hell, about the authority of Scripture, and so on. We also ask other questions about religious practices. How often do you attend religious services? How often do you pray? How often do you read Scripture? And by asking a lot of questions on all these different topics, you can begin to get a feel for the full picture. People who identify themselves as Catholics, for example, tend to have certain beliefs and certain behaviors, but there's not a perfect correlation. There are some Catholics who don't fit the traditional mold, so to speak, and the same thing is true of every religious group. So what we try to do is look at lots of different indicators of lots of different elements of what it means to be religious mm-hmm. and hopefully use that to get as full a picture as we can get.
Do you have any idea of whether or not the percentages of the 35,000 that you report on, are they anywhere near the same percentages of minority religions in the United States?
We do find that that group is growing, that the share of people who identify with non-Christian faiths like Islam and Hinduism mm-hmm. and Buddhism is growing. Mm-hmm. In the current survey, we find about 6% of adults identifying as part of non-Christian faiths. Mm-hmm. The largest of those is Judaism, but it also includes Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists. We do have to keep in mind that this survey is conducted in English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. So if there are immigrant groups who consist of a disproportionately large number of people who would not be comfortable completing an interview in English or Spanish, then we might not cover those groups quite as well as surveys that had more languages. But we think that this is the best approach we can get for getting as broad a picture as possible in the United States.
Now here's the impossible question. Put these two reports together and then tell us where religion in America is today and whether or not you think it's going to stay like this or where it's headed in the future.
Well, I think that as far as the state of religion in America today, I think what we can say is that the U.S. religious landscape is going through some important changes. The number of people who say they don't identify with any religious group is going up very rapidly. And the share of American adults who are highly religiously observant is dropping modestly, but significantly. So these are important changes that are underway. As for the future, I don't have a crystal ball. Things can change. People can change. But one really interesting finding from these surveys is that there's a very important generational component to these trends. Yeah. That is to say, a big part of what's happening is that you have older generations of Americans, baby boomers, people from the silent generation, who are, by and large, quite religious, quite religiously observant. Mm-hmm. And as those older generational cohorts begin to pass away, and as their numbers begin to dwindle, they are being replaced by a new generation of young people, especially millennials, who are simply far less religious than their parents and mm-hmm. grandparents. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean going forward? It's hard to say for sure. It certainly is possible that young people who are not particularly religious today may become more religious as they get older. Previous research suggests that that's not unusual as people get older. However, we haven't seen much evidence of that in these two big studies. In fact, if anything, older millennials, those who were in their late teens and early 20s a few years ago and who are now in their late 20s and early 30s, if anything, that group may have become less religious since we last did this big study.
Hmm. Dr. Greg Smith is the principal researcher for the 2014 American Religious Landscape Study from the Pew Research Center. This week, Pew has issued its second report based on the responses received from 35,000 survey participants nationwide. The report is available online at pewforum.org, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Dr. Smith, this is invaluable information, and I thank you so much for being with us again to help us understand the insights available in this research.
My pleasure, and I'm happy to join you anytime.
Rabbi Jack Moline is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance and spends much of his time working on national policy issues in a small Washington, D.C. office that I know very well. But a key part of the job is staying abreast of developments across the country. And Jack has recently been traveling to a number of Interfaith Alliance affiliates across the country. Even as this tour continues, I'm very happy to have Jack with us today to share some of the insights his travels have provided for him so far. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio, and where did I reach you today?
You reached me, Welton, in Ocala, Florida, where I have the privilege of spending some time with our Marion County affiliate. They're doing great things down here.
Well, I want you to talk about the places that you've been recently and the kind of challenges those local communities face on Interfaith Alliance's key issues.
Yeah, I have actually been doing a lot of traveling the last couple of weeks. I've had an opportunity to meet with our folks in Denver, Colorado, the Interfaith Alliance of Colorado. Jay Keller from our office and I went up to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania for the 10th anniversary of Interfaith Alliance Pennsylvania, and now here I am in Ocala, Florida, in the Marion County Interfaith Alliance. And what we're finding is that many of the same issues we're dealing with nationally, religious freedom, Islamophobia, and just the bad behavior of people with extreme religious views, are things that are being dealt with on a local level as well. But they have their own issues, too. You know that our affiliates have a little more latitude in defining their agenda than we seek to impose on them, which is the right thing to do. Religious freedom is a local issue. So the folks in Pennsylvania were working hard on making sure that the right kinds of representation on the Supreme Court came to pass. And indeed, they have justices who will uphold a genuine religious freedom agenda. The folks in Denver are working on religious freedom legislation they're hoping to prevent that hasn't reached the State House yet. It's been blocked before, and they're hoping to do that again. And here in Ocala, I had the privilege of speaking so far with a group of students at the College of Central Florida who were very, very concerned about understanding Sharia law and what its impact, what its engagement is in the American scene. Very, very intelligent questions from this community college class.
Are there aspects of what you have seen and what you've heard that cause a light bulb to go off and you say, you know, that is really information we need in the national office, and I think we can benefit from giving some attention to this?
So I think it has reinforced what we hope to embark on very, very soon, which is developing, for lack of a better term, metrics to measure religious freedom in the United States generally and state by state. That we are having a conversation about something that everybody is defining for himself or herself. And we really need to understand what religious freedom means and how it's being practiced in the individual states. And the very fact that I'm hearing similar but not identical concerns in all these places I've been leads me to believe that if we're ever going to get to the root of this, we in Interfaith Alliance have an opportunity to create a conversation that will sort of level the playing field and allow people to compare apples to apples.
Tell me, Jack, what are the apples? What are the items we need to compare?
We need to be able to look at all of these mini RFRAs, these mini Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, and be able to say these provisions are applicable in a constitutionally defined society, and these provisions are nothing more than an excuse for religious discrimination. And rather than take an aim like we're a whack-a-mole gallery at 50 different versions of this legislation, if we at least knew what we were talking about, we would be able to say, there's a good one in that state over there, and there's one that isn't so good in the state on the other side.
Oh, that's great. Interfaith Alliance provides five questions that voters need to ask political candidates. What role will your faith or values play in creating public policy or making appointments? To the candidate, what are your views on the boundaries between religion and government? What steps will you take to protect the rights of your constituents regardless of faith or belief? How will you speak about your beliefs without making them just another political tool? How will you balance the principles of your faith and your obligation to defend the Constitution, particularly if the two come into conflict? Every voter has a right to know what every candidate feels about those five questions. Talk about, Jack, the initiative to get those questions in front of the candidates campaigning in communities all across the nation.
Yeah, so those are the five questions, and they're extraordinarily important for individuals to ask candidates, because mostly what we hear when people are asked about religious faith are ridiculous questions about Bible verses and who's middle of the road and whose side of the road and that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the real issues are legislators need to legislate on the basis of the Constitution, on the basis of state and local law, and not on the basis of religious faith.
Mm-hmm.
Much of the conversation we have about these kinds of concerns are more about whether the candidate who is campaigning is like me, rather than whether the candidate who's campaigning is going to be a good legislator.
Mm-hmm.
And those five questions are designed to sort of ferret out the role that religious faith plays in the individual candidate's life and to make the point subtly and I think politely that our expectation is that a legislator is going to legislate and not pontificate.
Mm-hmm. Jack, have you, in listening to the debates and just what you've heard on news shows, is there any candidate that's getting it right, whether or not the questions have come from Interfaith Alliance or from some other source?
I'm discouraged by what I've heard from moderators, and not just on this question of religious freedom. We haven't really heard any of the moderators on the debates on either side of the aisle talk about the issues that we're concerned about.
Yeah.
So what I think will be right is if the model of the moderator, who is well prepared with the facts and asking questions rather than provoking challenges, will create a conversation among candidates that will help people understand who's going to lead and how they're going to lead. And I would hope that, more importantly, the leadership in both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans both, would be ready to repudiate within their own party inappropriate comments about faith, about the role of faith in our civic life, and about the inappropriate depiction of a particular kind of religious culture in America.
I can't imagine that people listening to this show and listening to this particular interview would not be saying, look, we're doing the best we can to understand where these candidates are on a lot of issues, and it's very difficult sometimes and frustrating at other times to do that. So where could we get our hands on those five questions that Interfaith Alliance has prepared? We'd like to use them with candidates coming our way. What's your answer to how they get it?
The best place to look for those five questions is on our website, interfaithalliance.org. And just click through to the five questions. There's also a guide for houses of worship and a guide for candidates as to how to talk about these issues. But I'd also like to suggest that people be a little patient. We have not seen a lot of substance in the campaign so far. We've seen a lot of entertainment. We've seen a lot of posturing. We've seen a lot of people trying to put themselves as a leading candidate by pandering to the people they think will vote in the primaries. I think we need to be a little patient. We're just past the off-year election date. where a lot of local contests were decided and a lot of statewide nominations were confirmed. And now I think it's time in earnest to start pressing candidates who are serious about holding public office about where they stand on these five questions.
I know that you are very interested in what you're doing out with various members of Interfaith Alliance in different parts of the country, and I know you're also holding that in balance with watching what's going on in the primaries that is of interest to someone interested in what's happening to religious freedom. But I also know that the end of the year is coming, and you're probably looking as well at the budget and the budget in relation to the kind of things that you want to be doing at the end of this year and the beginning of next year. So here comes what probably should be a fastball right down the middle that's going to look to you like a softball size, and you can hit it as far as you want to. Talk a little bit about Interfaith Alliance and its need for support for this important work.
So there are two things that every listener needs to do. The first is to congratulate Reverend C. Welton Gaddy on being honored by Muslim Advocates for his great service to the Muslim community coming up their annual dinner on December 3rd. But the second thing is, now that we're getting to the end of the year, now that we're looking at closing out our budget year and putting ourselves on a firm foundation for the year to come, we'd like everybody to try to be as generous as they possibly can. Your contributions to Interfaith Alliance are tax deductible. And believe me, you get a lot more bang for your buck with us than you do with most other institutions. What we're able to accomplish on a very frugal budget, I have to tell you, finding ourselves on the front pages of the New York Times and USA Today, in the pages of the New Republic and the Wall Street Journal, those are things that our listeners and our supporters can understand are having a huge impact on what we hope to accomplish in the United States today.
Rabbi Jack Moline has served as a congregational rabbi for over 30 years, most recently in Alexandria, Virginia. Having held a number of leadership positions for numerous Jewish, interfaith, and community organizations, today Jack is executive director at Interfaith Alliance. Jack, safe travels. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton. Keep up the good work.
Fear and hatred have been dogging American Muslims and even non-Muslims who are perceived to be Muslim, particularly since 9/11. At the same time, misunderstandings about the religion are widespread and affect many even within the world of Islam. So perhaps now, more than ever, a responsible and comprehensive look at the teachings of Islam is in order. An ambitious new book is about to be released by Harper One, titled The Study Quran, A New Translation and Commentary. And joining me now from the United Arab Emirates is one of the scholars who participated in this project, Dr. Joseph Lombard. Dr. Lombard, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for having me, Reverend Gaddy.
I want to begin by asking you to help me describe to our listeners the Study Quran. What is it?
Well, the Study Quran is the first Quran in any Western language to have, along with the translation, about a million words of commentary that help one understand the historical context of certain verses of the Quran and to understand how many verses of the Quran have actually been interpreted by Muslims throughout Islamic history. So it offers a kind of complete, comprehensive introduction to the text and lets one dig deep into certain passages that one might want to further engage.
Mm-hmm.
And accompanying that, it's got 17 essays that also touch upon important aspects of the Quran.
Mm. How did you come to participate in this project?
Well, I sat down to lunch with Sayyid Hussein Nasser back in February of 2006, I guess it was.
Hmm.
And he told me that he had been asked to do this and that he wanted me to join him as one of the editors. He and I assembled the rest of the editorial team, and we started a project that took us up until today, and it's coming out this month.
Yeah. Who are the other contributors? What are these all scholars in the Quranic literature?
All the other editors, Yener Dali, Maria Daycake, who are also general editors with me, they're also scholars who are Muslim but are also trained in the Western academic tradition, conversant in Quranic Arabic and Quranic studies.
Mm-hmm.
And then our assistant editor, Mohammed Rustam. So we're all people who come from different, slightly different backgrounds, but have all been trained in the West and worked extensively with the Quran in many different ways.
Dr. Lombard, why did you think this was needed, particularly right now?
Well, I think there's a tremendous lack of literacy regarding Islam and what Muslims actually say and actually believe.
Mm-hmm.
With this volume, there will be things that people will disagree with, but at least they're going to know what Muslims actually think about these things rather than many of the misrepresentations that we find flying around everywhere from the halls of the Vatican to the halls of academia to talk radio.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, was there anything that was new to you that came up while you were working on this project?
A million things. I mean, being this deeply engaged in the over 1,000 years of scholarship regarding the Quran that's been written by Muslims opens up so many vistas within the tradition. I have a lifetime of projects built up just from the things that I noticed within this. But I think one of the things that really evades a lot of people is the real plurality of the classical Islamic tradition. It's something that people like me who study the tradition, we know in principle. But then when you really start digging into it and you really see how diverse the tradition has been and the many different ways in which verses of the Quran for which you might think, oh, there's one general interpretation, but the many different ways in which it's been engaged over the years, this is something that it's like the stunning complexity of a crystal. The more you look into it, the more amazing you find it is.
Hmm. I know that there can be all kinds of debate about interpretations of the text, but my guess is there were also debates about the accuracy of the text. Tell us how you resolved which text of the Quran did you use, and were all of you comfortable with the one that's being published?
We're all very comfortable with the one that's being published. There were, of course, differences of opinion. Now, I have to ask you a question for that. I gather that you're referring to the idea that there might be somewhat different versions of the original Quran?
Yes, and I don't know whether I'm asking that question the right way or not, because I think there are descriptions of teachings that some people identify as the Quran and some other people identify as something that's not really the Quran, but is legitimately a part of a discussion of it.
Within the Quranic text itself, there is very standard agreement, particularly within the Islamic tradition, as to what is the actual text. There are multiple readings of the text.
Mm-hmm.
Those readings can sometimes lead to slight variations
mm-hmm.
at times, but what we did was in the commentary, we would incorporate those variations in the readings when they had a significant impact on the interpretation of the text.
Mm-hmm.
When the slight variations in how you might read something did not have a significant impact on the interpretation of the text, we didn't put that in the commentary. Now, there's one particular reading of the Quran that is the most widespread today,
mm-hmm.
and that's the one that we employed. And there are two or three places where we used one of the other readings of the text in the translation because it made more sense in the translation. It made more sense to us overall.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, we've used that particular reading style, which is known as the Hafs reading style.
Okay. As I'm sure you've experienced, and as certainly I've experienced in being an interpreter
of the Bible, both the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures, people proof text. They rip texts out of their context and make them mean whatever they want them to mean rather than what the text itself in its original context meant. What are some of the texts that you think are most important for people to understand in order to be correct in their interpretation of Islam?
Some of the texts to understand, well, that's a good question. I think that one of the things that is most important for people to actually understand it, and I think that almost all Muslim scholars throughout history would agree with me on this, is the opening chapter of the Quran. And that's why our interpretation of it is actually the longest in terms of the percentage of commentary to actual words of translation. Because mm-hmm. when one digs into it, it really, in a sense, contains the whole of the message of the Quran and the whole of the message of Islam mm-hmm. in many ways. But it's interesting that you mention this phenomena of proof texting. Because within the classical Islamic tradition, from the very beginning of the commentary tradition, scholars were wary of the ways in which people might do this. And one of the things that they did that really makes Quranic commentary very different from what you have with biblical commentary mm-hmm. is that there was a very deep effort to try to confirm the exact historical circumstances of each particular verse. Mm-hmm. So if you have a verse, that, for example, a famous verse that comes up a lot in the Quran is people say that in Surah 5 of the Quran, it says, do not take the Jews and Christians as friends. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not actually what it says. When you actually go into it and you look at it and you see the word awliya that people translate as friends, in modern Arabic, you can translate that as friends. But in classical Arabic, especially in the verse that it's used, it actually means don't take them as allies. Mm. And the verse is telling Muslims at the time, don't try to kind of hedge your bets about whether or not Islam is going to succeed by making alliances with other groups and other tribes in case it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Now, in other words, you know, if you're going to be with us, you're going to be with us. If you're not going to be with us, don't try and hedge your bets both ways. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the actual historical circumstance of the verse, that exact meaning becomes clear. So it's something that Muslims have always guarded against. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen. But this is actually what you see today with a group like ISIS. Mm-hmm. I mean, they proof text to the extreme. Mm-hmm. And that's why every single classically trained Islamic scholar in the world today rejects them outright. And they've signed documents against them, and some of them have given their lives to oppose them. Mm-hmm. It's because that is taking proof text to its very dangerous extreme.
My hope is that the readers of this volume are not just Muslims. I hope the readers are widespread in Christianity and in Judaism and in other religions. I think it can be so helpful there if people will learn from it. What do you hope readers of this book will gain from reading the new translation as well as the commentaries?
Well, for Muslims, I hope that they will gain a greater literacy of the tradition. You know, even a lot of Muslims who can read Arabic don't have the ability to necessarily read the classical commentaries in Arabic, and we used some that were in Persian as well. Mm-hmm. So I hope that Muslims will gain that greater religious literacy. Mm-hmm. I also hope that non-Muslims will go to the text with an open mind mm-hmm. because really, look, when it comes to the community for whom we can say this is their book, it's us. This mm-hmm. is the book of the Muslims. And it's our responsibility to represent it properly. And I think that there's a degree to which that hasn't fully happened mm-hmm. in the West. It's our responsibility to represent it properly, and it's also our right to do so. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, with this volume, I hope that we have taken on that responsibility and in a sense seized that right, and that it will put us into a genuine dialogue with people of other faiths and people mm-hmm. who are not of faith, mm-hmm. who are from outside the Muslim tradition, so that at least when they come to ask us something, it will be based upon what our tradition actually says, mm-hmm. rather than what some pundit out there says Islam says when Muslims sit there and say, what? I've never heard a Muslim say that. So I'm hoping that it will basically improve the dialogue for everyone involved.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, that is a great hope I have for you, too. I'd like for you to talk just a second about the launch event for the Study Quran this week in Washington. I know you're scheduled to be there for this event. We will have people from State of Belief there and people from Interfaith Alliance there. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be in D.C., and I can't. But tell us just a little bit about that.
Well, we're going to have the major media launch event Thursday, November 12th at Georgetown University, and Syed Hussein Nasser, the editor-in-chief, will be there, and myself and the other general editors, as well as Imam Sohaib Webb, and then it will be chaired by Mahdi Hassan, who's with Al Jazeera, among other things. Mm-hmm. And we hope that it will be an event where people can ask questions, such as the ones that you're asking, and will help other people to start viewing this text as a major move towards a broader and more effective engagement with Islam in the West.
Good. The Study Quran, a new translation and commentary, is being released Tuesday by Harper One with a launch event in Washington, D.C. We'll post information at stateofbelief.com. Dr. Joseph E.B. Lombard is currently a professor at the American University of Sharjah in the Department of Arabic and Translation Studies, a translator, commentary, author, and general editor for the Study Quran. He's also a former advisor for interfaith affairs to King Abdullah II of Jordan, and he's taken part in several interfaith dialogues, among them the Common Word Initiative, an important initiative. Dr. Lombard, I've already said I'm excited about the release of this publication. I'm grateful to you and your colleagues for the time and scholarly energy that you poured into it. And I'm really thankful for you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, Reverend Gaddy, thank you very much for having me. It was an honor.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. That ought to be enough to think about for a long time, and maybe even some actions can be taken on what you're thinking. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We rely on listener support to keep this show on the air. As the end of the year gets closer, please consider a tax-deductible contribution to State of Belief and Interfaith Alliance. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to friends or acquaintances, please tell them about the show. Share the interviews with them. It's very easy to do in Facebook, Twitter, and at stateofbelief.com, of course. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today, a member of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.